Most of us have something we're passionate about. Maybe it's music or literature or sports. And then we have our day job. You're about to meet a man who realized early in life he had a passion for history and a passion for teaching. He was able to be a history teacher right here at Hingham High School for almost 50 years. He's retiring now. This is one of his students, Mark Landers, in conversation with James Kirkcaldy. For the audience, they should know that you are retiring after 48 years. And I was your student in 95, 96, which is 24 years ago now.
Thanks for reminding me.
Well, thanks for reminding myself.
It's funny when you look back on the years, it's hard to picture 48 years here.
I know. Did you think about going for an even 50?
It sounds good, but I'm still teaching some part-time course at the college level, so I'll be able to celebrate, I'm sure, 50 years of teaching eventually. So
nice.
I'll have to settle for that.
So I guess we could start with, do you have any specific memories of the 1990s?
Actually, it becomes a blur, to be honest with you. Yeah. I can remember the hairstyles being different. It's interesting to look in the yearbooks and remember the boys with long hair, for example, and things that. So obviously you can see, and I can remember some of the cultural differences.
Sure.
I can even remember a time, it may have been in the 90s, when streaking was even rather popular in the school.
Even in the 90s?
I'm not sure if it's the 90s or the 80s, but I do remember streaking, and that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it's more like more of a cultural thing, I think.
How about from the 70s when you started to now? Like, a lot of kids now are on their cell phones, and people would say that electronic distractions are an issue compared to then.
It hasn't been a problem with my teaching. I can remember the first time, even when we got our first computers. When I started teaching, we had mimeograph machines and film strip projectors, overhead projectors, which some of the kids wouldn't know what those equipment are anymore. That's the funny thing. And I can remember writing off a test on a mimeograph machine, smelling the ink, and grading by hand and all that type of stuff. So I've seen a lot of transitions. And obviously, electronically, that's made my job easier, being able to do. I remember I always did a lot with art, and I'd have to take pictures of paintings or borrow slides. And now, of course, the internet, I can find any painting I want and make PowerPoints, which has changed my teaching dramatically and actually more fun to create those types of things, you know. So that part's been all good. But in terms of kids with phones, I think that's always a challenge for parents as well. You know, the kids on their phone at night when they should be doing homework or should be in bed and stuff like that. But it's never been a trouble in class telling kids to put their phones away and stuff like that.
I remember the slide projectors. You had to feed them in from the top, right?
Yeah.
And then it was like in a carousel or something.
Yeah. I used to love to do little jokes with my students, and I had a overhead projector in the class with a little door. And I'd put it in another teacher's class sometimes. And I'd come in, excuse myself, and walk up to the overhead projector, take out some money and slip it into the door, and open the door and take out a can of Coke, and then leave the room. And kids would say, you can get Coke machines. You can get Cokes out of these. And of course, it just cracked up the kids.
That's hilarious.
That was one of my, I can't do that anymore because they wouldn't know what the overhead projector is.
The whole setup would be lost.
But it was fun. It was great to do that.
Well, that brings me to the next topic. You're known for your quirky, offbeat, sometimes sardonic sense of humor.
My philosophy of education is, and I'm very serious about this, is I try to make them laugh and smile every class. I can't tell a stand-up joke to save my life, but I know how to, in a positive way, is to tease kids, like the example I just gave in some cases, or using a dead banana as a pointer, or just using the material. Some of the best comic material is in history, of course. The idiosyncrasies of famous people and what life was like 100, 200 years ago and stuff like that. And I very often can use that for the humor. But my feeling is if they enjoy the class, I can make them laugh. I can also demand a great deal of quality work from them as well. I want them to want to come to class and want them to feel comfortable. And to me, it's been the key to hopefully my success.
Does that reflect your personality in real life?
Yeah, I think so. I'm always joking around a lot and, you know, it makes it a lot of fun. I have a running debate with Andy Hoy, who's the current department head, that we've never had a conversation yet seriously without he and I doing something to make the other laugh or, you know, and we said to ourselves, we haven't done it yet. We always say, sometime before I leave, we have to have a serious conversation without any jokes, okay? And it didn't happen.
in terms of that, I remember you would tease students at certain times, like, and you'd also be very friendly in the hallways.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's another thing. I've always tried to treat them as I would treat anyone else, not looking down at them as students. If I saw kids in the hallway when I'm walking down, I always say hi to everyone, even if I don't know them. And if there's an opportunity, I might even ask them how the day's going, and sometimes I'll even introduce myself. I say, I'm Mr. Kirkcaldy, what's your name? Stuff like that. And I think that's all part of that. Kids like to be recognized, actually. And once again, I've never really had issues with kids, confrontational issues, I think, because mostly I just try to be sure I'm concerned and that I treat them as respect and that they treat me the same way. And I can diffuse a lot of issues that way.
I have nothing but fond memories of your school, of your class. I can't say that about every teacher I've had.
Well, this is a long time ago now, but I still remember this. It was in 1997. And the reason I remember that class was I have a daughter who was also a junior in 97. So, but in class, I don't remember how it came up, but this girl said to me, oh, you're the one that says hi to everybody. And it really made an impact on me because, I mean, these are high school kids. Why would they be talking about a teacher who says hi to them? But it must have made a difference. Like, that's not something they're used to. And the fact that they were talking about it said I was doing something right then, you know? So I never forgot that little incident, but it does make a difference.
I know that you would also like to hook in students with quirky details about historical figures.
Of course, yeah, yeah. And that's, you know, when I first started teaching, one of the things I always would look up, the basic historical facts and the accomplishments of people are pretty easy to find, but I always like to look up their life, you know, idiosyncrasies. We even have a famous body parts list that the kids will still keep. One of the teachers here, Jamie Cataldo, I had her as a student, and she has my workbook on her desk, on her shelf, and she also kept her body parts list, like who had one arm shorter than the other, Stalin and Kaiser Wilhelm II, or who was the tallest czar in history, Peter the Great, and who had six fingers. That's a good one, Anne Boleyn. And, you know, just we make little jokes about it, and kids would keep their body parts list and stuff like that. But it's a great hook. You know, you want kids to realize, to me, history is a great story. I've always been fortunate that I made a career out of a hobby. I read history for enjoyment, and to be able to share it with kids is great. And so I'm always looking for those little anecdotal stories to grab them. And my greatest pleasure is when a student will say to me, oh, I'd like to read more about that person or something like that. And then from there you can go on and do your activities and do more concentrated studies that you might call is more important. But like I said, it's very important for me that they enjoy the class. And they realize that history is a great story. And also, it's to me, if you don't know history, it's a form of amnesia. How can you make current decisions if you don't know how people have acted in the past? There's an old cliche about history repeats itself, but I like Mark Twain's comment better. History may not repeat itself, but it rhymes. And to me, I don't care if I've had a lot of students that go into the math and sciences, but I always say history is a course you should take because it's going to help you in your everyday life and, as an American citizen, you know. To see how did other people deal with issues we're facing now? And part of critical thinking is making analogies, you know, and being able to judge, are they good analogies or not? And that's one of the key things I've always wanted to do is teach critical thinking to my students.
Now, in terms of the class that you taught or that you're most famous for, it's AP European History.
Right, Advanced Placement European History.
Advanced Placement, yeah. Now, a lot of people may not know what the deal is with Advanced Placement. It's well, I remember in our day, and I don't know if it's still the same, but there were different levels of classes. There were standard, upper standard, advanced, and then in senior year you could do advanced placement,
right,
which ended with a test. Now, from what I recall, you taught to the test, but it wasn't just that.
No. There's a very active AP program throughout the country, actually, and what it is, in May you take an exam, and if you get the scores are from 0 to 5, and then it helps you get into college. The fact that you're taking, the college would like to see you're taking a challenging course in your junior or senior year. And then also, if you do well, usually 4 or 5, sometimes 3 even, you get college credit. So it's the one way for students to save some money in college.
Yeah, it was for me.
My own son graduated in 3.5 years instead of 4 because of credit he took. And the other thing is it's a good, just a good prep for college. You know, the students will say that the writing skills that they learned helped them do well in college and stuff like that. But to me, it's the course stands by itself. And I never taught just to the test. I do a lot of workshops training teachers in AP European History, how to teach the course. And what I try to always instill in them is the test is not the end all. You want them to, you teach a good class, teach them to be able to write and to think, and the test will take care of itself, pretty much. And we've had great success with that.
Among the things that were related to history that were could be considered outside of history were art and philosophy that you introduced us to. I know with art, you took us to the Gardner Museum, perhaps on more than one occasion.
Yeah, in fact, I've had so much pleasure and gotten so much feedback from using the art. Now, a lot of teachers will use art and paintings and stuff like that, but I found that art is a good way to explain the philosophies. Like, you can see romanticism, you can see existentialism through the art. But also, I took the time, and this is, once again, nothing that, I don't think anyone really does this, to tell you the truth, but I took time to teach them some of the tricks of the trade of the artists. In other words, how do they use color? Blue makes an object look farther away, where red makes it look closer. That behind every painting is geometry, and how to look underneath to see how the painting pulls together, and how the artist decides what you see and when you see it. And what that did was give the skills to the students to look at art, and the discussions. Kids were even quiet, all of a sudden would come to life. So when we go to an art museum, for example, it's enjoyable. I think going to an art museum, quite frankly, and not knowing anything about art can be boring. You don't tell people that, but you're probably saying to yourself, okay, I've had enough. And by the way, just in general, it's always good not to do too much, but when you're on a world trip to the France, of course, and you're in the Louvre for one day, you got to make the most of it, of course. But still, if you can, just to go in and look at a few things. I had a very heartwarming email just since the last time I saw you. First of all, Andy Hoy, who is now the current department, did a wonderful thing for me. I think it was him, or maybe someone else in the department had the idea. They put out a blog asking students to thank me for retiring. And I was getting notes from students I had in the 70s. And it was heartwarming, actually, to see. So I recognized some of the names, and they were telling me what they were doing and how much the class and what I taught them helped and stuff. So it's probably the most heartwarming thing I've ever received, because when we get compliments from your students, that always means the most, I think. But there was one girl, she wrote to me, and she said, I don't know if you remember me, and she told me who she was, and she had three other brothers, and she said she really enjoyed my class. But she focused on this. She said, by the way, I married a German scientist. I live in Germany now, and my mother told me that you're retiring, so blah, 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 that type of thing. And then she said, even though I'm a math and science person, I've always enjoyed going to art museums because of you. And I married a German scientist, and he didn't care too much about the arts, but now he also enjoys. And I still remember some of the things you taught us about how to, the little quirky things about the artists or how to examine art. And now we're doing that with our daughter. So it's like, wow, you know, it really made a difference. And I got a chill when I read that.
Wow.
You know, here I am. I had an impact on her, she had an impact on her husband, and now maybe their daughter will enjoy art. But she still remembered some of the things to tell to her husband to make it more interesting and stuff. And very often when the students do journal writing for me, they'll comment on the art, that they never appreciated art before. And now when I take them, like you said, to the Gardner Museum, and then we go to the MFA at night, usually in the spring, because it's free Wednesday night. And sometimes seniors are so busy, I don't have time to take them during the day, so we get a bus and they enjoy going. We used to go to Faneuil Hall to get something to eat first. Bus picks us up at 6, be at the museum by, let's say, 7:30, leave by 9:30, and they would have a blast, you know. But to see them excited about the art because they knew they could relate to it. And when we go to the garden, I always say, okay, take someone in your family, bring them back here and give them a tour, because you can do that. So the art, and that's what I mean about it's a life skill. And it helps also if a student doing an AP exam can pull in the art to explain whatever they're writing about, that's also going to boost their grade probably, because it shows a higher depth of thinking and tying with other disciplines. And same idea with philosophy too. I found that the philosophy intellectual movements are really big on the exam, and something I've enjoyed and the students seem to enjoy too. So it's a great overview course, because it's not just European history. It's like I said, art, it's philosophy, it's foreign affairs, it's economic theory. We really get into a lot of this stuff. And so when they go off to college, it's a great prep for them. And as you can probably tell, I thoroughly enjoy doing this. That was, it wasn't even work for me, it wasn't work.
That's amazing. You talked about a student of yours who married a German scientist, but did you have any notable students in and of themselves?
Who became famous?
Became famous, yes.
I'm sure many success in their own right. I know some have become doctors and have done well. The only one of some, I had a student who became a lawyer for the Clintons in the White House, and I was doing taking a workshop at National Geographic's, and this was around 90, in the late 90s, about 97 I think it was, and he was working for the Clintons at that time, And he invited me to a tour of the White House at night, which was like a VIP tour type of thing. So it was interesting to see how well he's done. He's still doing very well. I think he's working for a large bank in Boston. But just the fact that he was, you know, could tell me these anecdotal stories about Hillary and Bill, because he worked with them, you know. And it was very interesting. And once again, having a tour like that, I had my picture taken at the, you know, when they do the press conferences with the White House logo and everything.
Oh, wow. Do you still have that picture?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. I might ask you for that for people.
Yeah.
So let's take us back to the beginning. At what age, when did you start teaching? What year, what age?
15. No, that's not
true.
Wow. No. Okay. I graduated from Bridgewater State College. I'd gone to a tech school, actually. That always surprises people, because at that point, I grew up in Springfield, and you picked your high school. It was very unusual. There was classical for humanities, trade for trade, commerce for business, and tech was for math and science. And I went to a math science high school, because at that time I was kind of being prepped by my uncles for one of the service academies, like Annapolis or West Point, and that was a great school to prep for that. But I always liked history. I've always felt that was my favorite subject, and I was trying to do something maybe I wasn't really that good at. And so I decided my junior year I want to be a history teacher, and I never deviated from that.
That's
so a history teacher. And so my guidance counselor said, well, there's a good teacher's college called Bridgewater. Never heard of it, growing up in Springfield, Western Mass. So I went there, and that was fine. And I minored in German and education. And then I got my master's at University of Rhode Island, versus going someplace that I had to pay money. They paid me. I got a teaching assistantship there. And so that was like a two-year appointment. But jobs were scarce back then. So after my first year, I was starting to look around for jobs. I heard about a job in Hingham, which I didn't even know where it was. And I always have a soft spot for Ruth Butterfield, who was department head back then, because she saw something in me, and she hired me, and my life, you know, obviously would never be the same without her, because I could have gotten a job in other school systems, but Hingham's been a great place to work. And when I compare my job situation with others in other schools, I always come away feeling I'm better off in Hingham. And her job was K through 12, which is unusual. Most school systems to this day, they don't have department heads that are K through 12. They're usually just for the high school or maybe the middle school. And when I became department head after 20 years teaching, K through 12 just made a lot of sense. You can kind of coordinate the system, social studies with kindergarten teacher all the way through. And the Hingham administrators always had enough faith in me, they let me pick the teachers. By law, I don't hire teachers, but in essence, I did. So the staff are all people I picked, and there was never any politics. No one ever said, no, we want you to hire this guy because he's a football coach, or he's, you know, my brother's wife, or whatever that kind of stuff might be. And that's highly unusual, too.
That kind of stuff happens in other school systems?
Yeah, sometimes. Or at least, if it doesn't happen, the principals have more say, and I think it's a power thing, if you will. You know, they have the right to do it, and they do it. They take into account, obviously, what the department head says, but that was always, what do you think? And so it really was kind of neat that way.
It's very cool.
I always joke with them, they're the current teachers. I hired most of them, or I had them as students, and they're like the age of my own children. So they're like an extended family, so it'd be hard for me not to visit them for lunch or see them when times improve, when this pandemic is over, because I do have a vested interest in their lives as they get married and have children, and keep in touch with them. It's nice.
When you started teaching at Hingham, you were still doing your master's program when you started, right?
Yeah, and I finished that off. I'd leave here and drive to URI after school.
Wow.
Sometimes, and I got that in 74.
You didn't start out teaching AP Euro?
No. In fact, a lot of people, like you said, they only know me as an AP teacher, but for the first 20-odd years, I taught mostly sophomores. I've taught juniors and seniors and so forth, but I was hired mainly to teach a course back then called Russia-China. And that's what they needed, someone who had a course in Chinese history. And what it was the first semester was Chinese history and the second half was Russian. And the sophomores had a choice of taking that or another region, like Africa, Middle East, or Latin America, Africa. And they also had a choice in sociology or economics. Those were sophomore courses back then.
Oh.
It was great to have a whole semester teaching about Russian history, but later the next department head, Dan LeClaire, realized that it gave the kids kind of a narrow introduction to world history. So we went to a broad type of world history course, more traditional, and did away with that. But my job was mostly 10th grade, and I taught different electives and so forth. But back then, you mentioned it earlier, we did, whether pedagogically it was right or not, we did have upper standard classes, standard and advanced, based on different academic levels. And I taught the whole range of students. And for 20 years, I also taught the what we call the standard students. These are students who had either learning issues or not interested in school that much. And that was my forte, percent. And I got along fine with them, and that was what I was known for. You know, so I've taught the whole gamut, but no one knows about that now. That was a long time ago.
At what point did you become director of social studies yourself?
Around 93, I think.
Oh wow, before you had me.
Yeah, yeah. I was 20 years in the classroom, I think, as a teacher, and then department head since. And I think once again, I actually officially retired 5 years ago as a department head, because I realized at that point I wanted to do some other things. But I travel around the country doing workshops, training AP teachers. So I asked Dot Gallo if I could retire but still come in and teach one class, my AP class. And by that time too, I'd also hired another young lady, Catherine Black, who I had to teach the other AP class, so it'd be a smooth transition when I left, and she's doing a great job, you know. But so for the last 5 years, I've been just coming here to teach one class. Teachers look at me jealous, like, you know, I have lunch with them and say, okay, bye guys. And Dot said, no meetings, nothing, just come and teach you one class. And that's highly unusual too. Most teachers don't get a chance to do that.
The lack of meetings must have been nice.
Dot Gallo is a great superintendent, you know. And to show you how stable the Hingham schools are, and this could be a national record, I was here 48 years, right? And those 48 years, I only had four superintendents. And they only left pretty much when they were at the end of their career. That's highly unusual. It could be a national record.
Oh, wow.
If you talk to other teachers and other school systems, especially lately, superintendents come and go.
Oh, wow.
You know, they come in 5 years, do their damage, and leave, pretty much, you know?
Yeah.
But Hingham, I don't know how lucky they are to have had such great people. They were all really good.
Yeah. I mean, Hingham overall is just renowned for having a great school system and great education.
And like I said, I realized that when I've had dealings with other department heads, you know, and other friends in other schools. Yeah. And really great working here. That's why I would say I owe Ruth Butterfield a lot. Sometimes luck comes into your life, you know?
Yeah.
And no matter what your occupation is, if you have a boss that's very negative towards you, or just the working environment's not happy, it can drive you out of that, whether it's education or some other field. And so I was very lucky to get a job here.
You're still teaching, but you're now retiring from teaching itself.
At Hingham.
At Hingham. You're continuing to teach.
At Bristol Community College right now, some courses. And I'm learning new skills as I have to learn how to teach online. And I had to finish the class last year. It was like, just like here, I was with the class. I teach two classes, world and U.S. history. I also taught a lot of U.S. history while I was here too. And the class, as like a lot of college courses, I meet once a week. It's a night class, 7 to 9:30, with people who really don't want to be there. It's a course that, I got to take a U.S. history course, or something like that. And they're working during the day. But that's another whole challenge for me. And my greatest compliment is when they'll say to me at the end, what else are you teaching? So then I feel I've done something right. But going back to, hopefully I set a record by being the only Hingham teacher that had two retirement parties. 5 years ago and this year.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting that the end of your teaching career went into this pandemic.
I was sad about it. I mean, I love my students being in the class with them, so to not see them. We'd have a Zoom meeting once a week to see if they had homework to do, of course, but it's not the same. And so I would see them for that. And so I missed them, you know, and so it was nice. Looking back now, I guess I picked a pretty good year to retire because, as you know, it's not going to be very challenging what's going to happen in September. And even if they do come back in class, does that mean we may have to go into a lockdown later, as a lot of people think there could be another wave or whatever. So my courses in the college, that's all online right now for this upcoming September.
It's obvious that you have a great love of history and a love of teaching. And for you, and you've even said, like, to have been able to incorporate those into your career, it's like been a gift.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about history. Do you have a favorite period or location in the world or subject of history?
Well, it's like anything else that changes.
Yeah.
You know, when I got my master's in U.S. diplomatic history, and I would say now because of AP Euro, European history, but right now I like 19th century a lot, English history, but it changes. You know, there's, I think as a kid growing up, this is probably logical, going back to elementary school even, I became a Civil War buff. That was my intro into history. I loved the Civil War. And then as I got older, military history is always intriguing too. World War I, World War II. I think that grabs kids, maybe boys more than girls, I don't know. But the drama of war, ironically, is interesting, you know. But then as I got more mature, I just realized there's more than history than just war. So I ended up loving economics. And like I said earlier, philosophies, really into that a great deal. I love the intellectual history and showing students how that is a part of their life, whether they know it by name or not, you know, they're. Everything goes back to Aristotle and Plato, and even if they don't know it, they're influenced by that. So it changes a lot. And as I said, I think the art right now, art history is probably the thing I enjoy the most.
Nice.
One of my goals when this is over, the pandemic, to become a guide or a docent at the Gardner Museum, or I can't wait my resume to put down, well, this would be, I've done 90 tours of your museum, so I feel.
Yeah, look.
Look at this, 90 tours.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow, that's incredible.
I used to have like two classes, right? And so I'd do one class one day and the next class another week. So every year I did two tours at the Gardner, and you do the math and you can see it adds up.
Yeah. How many students have you had over the years, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, as a regular teacher, you're talking about roughly 100 students. And then when I started teaching AP, I'd have two groups and it might be 40, you know, so, but a few.
Now that you're retired, how do you think you'll be spending your time, aside from you're still teaching at the community college?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, because this is like new to me in a way. And I like to do more genealogy history, for example, and also enjoy my grandchildren. I'm lucky to have two children and four grandchildren. They all live in the area, so that makes it nice. And last year, viewers can identify with this if they're near my age, on Mondays and Wednesdays, I would pick my twin grandchildren off the bus in Easton at 10 of 4, and Tuesdays and Thursdays I'd get Alice out of daycare. And the thing I'm most proud of, I never screwed up. I got the right kids on the right days, you know. I didn't miss one day, you know.
Very nice.
Still got it. But so hopefully, you know, and that, but also, good question. Maybe do more, I live in Bridgewater and Hull, so get more involved in town. I used to be on the school committee in Bridgewater, for example, so maybe have more time to do involvement with my local town and stuff like that.
Well, I think we've covered everything I wanted to cover.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, thank you for sitting down with me and with Harbor Media and granting us your time. And
maybe add one thing you mentioned once before about, do I notice a change in kids over the years? And although I certainly would not say they haven't changed, but my personal sense is not really. You know, I said to you before, if you treat kids with respect and you're fair with them, they tend to respond. And, you know, I don't have any sense of, wow, kids were awful back then or they're awful now versus back then. I don't have that sense at all. But a personal touch goes a long way in terms of teaching. One last little story. I don't know how many years ago this was. We had a concert during the day and the jazz band was performing. And one girl had a solo. There were a lot of solos, but one girl had a solo on the keyboard. And later in the day, I saw her, and I stopped her and said who I was. I said, I really enjoyed your solo. And that was like in 10th grade. Later, I had her as a senior. At the end of the year, she said to me, you know, when you took me aside and told me that you really enjoyed that, that really meant a lot to me. And I thought, I mean, that seemed like such a little thing, you know? But she remembered that. And that kind of goes back to that other story I said about, oh, you're the guy who says hi to everyone in the hall. Little things like that, students seem to respect. I think we all like to be recognized. We all like to have someone take the time to say, well, I appreciate what you did. And I just try to do that all the time.
Well, I appreciate what you've done today for us. And it's clear that you love your students in addition to history.
That's the part I miss the most, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh man,
yeah.
Yeah.
I always say the best part of my day is in the classroom.
Well, we're back in the classroom
there
now.
There you go.
And it all comes full circle. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Kirk.
Good, thank you.